Is Christianity credible is the overall topic that we've been sharing together. We've already covered two topics, which worldview, theism, deism, pantheism of the alternatives, which one is correct, and we've concluded that of the five other worldviews, they're all problems, they seem to be unreasonable, and then we gave some reasons for theism in the second topic, does God exist, and concluded that the cosmological, moral, and teleological arguments show us that there is a moral and a powerful, indeed an all-powerful, moral and intelligent God, the equivalent of the first verse of the Bible, in the beginning, God. Now we turn our attention to the third topic, which is why evil? If there is an all-powerful, all-good God, why did he permit evil? Is there any purpose to pain? Is there any meaning to the misery we go through? Is there any real significance to suffering? Why does God allow the innocent to suffer? These kinds of questions. Really, there are three aspects of the problem of evil, and the first problem has to do with the reality of evil. And the little syllogism or logical outline that reveals the problem is as follows. If God is the author of everything and evil is something, then it would appear that God is the author of evil. Now think of that little logical outline for a moment. The Christian has to admit the first premise. God is the author of everything. He created everything. There's nothing outside of God. There's nothing that God didn't create. But the Christian also seems to be obligated to admit the second premise, that evil is something. We cannot say as the pantheist, because we've eliminated pantheism, that evil is not real, that evil is just an illusion. But if evil is real, and God is the author of everything that's real, then it would seem like God is the author of evil. That follows logically from a valid form of the syllogism. That is sometimes called the metaphysical problem of evil because it deals with the metaphysical or that which goes beyond the physical, the real world, the science of the real. How do we answer that? In brief, the answer is that we reject the second premise, which is called the minor premise. We reject that evil is something. And perhaps we could see it better if we separated the two parts of that word and said, evil is some thing. We argue that evil is not a thing, that there are no evil things in the world whatsoever, that everything in the world is morally neutral and metaphysically good. Let's start with the latter. When God created things, Genesis 1, after virtually every day and after all 6 days, it says, it is good, it is good, it is good, and after the sixth day, it is very good. So when he looked at his world, he pronounced it to be metaphysically good. That is, it was made perfectly. And so he could say, here is a good world. Nothing in all of creation is evil, because there are no evil things. Take some other verses in the Bible. Romans chapter 14 says, I am convinced that nothing is unclean in itself. Jesus said it's not what goes in a man that defiles him, it's what comes out of a man that defiles him. Evil is not found in things. 1 Timothy chapter 4, the Apostle Paul said, every creation of God is good. Every creature God made is good. He never made any evil creatures. You say, well, how about Lucifer? How about Satan? God never made an evil creature, including Lucifer. When he made Lucifer, he was entirely good. In fact, he was the most perfect thing he'd ever made. Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28 gives us a kind of picture of an absolutely perfect cherub angel that guarded the throne of God, who was perfect in his ways when God created him, but who decided to rebel against God. But everything about Lucifer was good. He had good mind, that's good. He had good power, that's good. He had good beauty, good perfections. All the things about him, his essence,
His attributes were all good. You say, well, what is evil? If Lucifer, if Satan is not evil, then what is evil? Aren't there some evil things in the world? How about alcohol? Is an alcohol an evil thing? No. Alcohol's got all good chemicals in, not an evil chemical in alcohol. Not an evil chemical in LSD. All the chemicals in all the things are good. Not an evil molecule in the universe. There aren't any wicked molecules floating around or little sinful atoms. I found a sinful atom. What is evil then? Evil is a bad relationship between good things. For instance, take the alcohol and put too much in the driver, you got a bad relationship. Put the alcohol in the radiator, good relationship. Keeps it from freezing up. They say it's better to have a loose nut behind the wheel than a tight one. So don't put too much alcohol in the driver. The driver and alcohol make a bad relationship. But there's nothing evil about the driver and nothing evil as such about alcohol. Just too much of it in that body makes a bad relationship. Same thing with any chemical or combination in the world. Or take the illustration of a gun. Nothing evil about a gun. It's made out of good metal. And you can be used for good purposes, hunting, for example, defending the innocent. But take a good gun and put your good finger on it and put the good barrel up to your good temple and pull your good finger on that good trigger and let that good piece of lead go through your good head, and what do you have? Bad relationship. bad relationship. Lead and head. No good. So evil is not in things. There are no evil things in the universe. There are just evil relationships between good things. Take a good thing, God, a good thing, Lucifer. And take that good thing and make him rebellious toward God. Bad relationship. Rebellion toward the God who made you is a bad relationship. Take two good persons and put them in love. Good relationship. Put them in a relationship of hate. Bad relationship. That didn't make the two things evil, just made the relationship between them evil. Now one of hate, then one of love. So what we like to say as Christians is God didn't make any evil things. And God didn't make any evil relationships. He made only good things. And therefore, the conclusion of the first syllogism there, that God is the author of everything and evil is the thing, therefore God is the author of evil, doesn't follow. Doesn't follow because evil is not in a thing. Evil has to do only with relationships between things, or, as we said there, evil is a privation or a lack in something. Let me give an illustration from science and then a couple commonsensical ones. Cancer, at least one form of cancer, is uncontrolled cell growth. That's a bad relationship between cells. They should not be acting that way. It's not that the cell as such is evil, or that the molecules or the atoms in the cell evil, but you've got a bad relationship among them. They should not be related that way and growing that way out of control. Or take a wound in your arm. What is a wound? A wound is a privation or a lack in your arm. You lack wholeness. Or if somebody cuts an arm off and you're maimed. You don't gain something when you get maimed, you lose something. You lose something that ought to be there. That's what is known as a privation. It's different from an absence because an absence is something that isn't there but shouldn't be there. A privation is something that isn't there but should be there. For instance, if I say the stone cannot see and the blind man cannot see, sight is absent in the stone, but not a privation. You say the stone is privated of sight. No, the stone is not privated of sight. It just doesn't have sight because stones aren't supposed to see. But a blind man is supposed to see by his nature, and he is privated of sight. So what is an absence in the stone is a lack or privation in the blind man. So evil is a kind of ontological parasite. It exists only in something else, but not in itself. You never find evil floating around. You find evil in things, like rust in a car. Evil is a lack, like rust is a lack in a car. But you never find a totally evil car. Because if you found a totally rusted car, it wouldn't be a car. You say, well, you've never seen my car. Well, It might be very rusted, but it's not totally rusted. It's like walking through the woods and running into rottenness. You never run into rottenness in the woods. You run into rotten trees. But a totally rotten tree wouldn't be a tree at all. Or going in the closet and finding a moth-eaten garment. You never find a totally moth-eaten garment. If it's totally moth-eaten, you don't find it. So there's nothing that's totally evil. Evil exists only in something else, like rust exists in iron, or like rot exists in a tree, or a wound in a body. So evil exists in another, but does not exist in itself. Evil is an ontological parasite that doesn't have any status of its own. It has a status only in something else, or as a relationship between two things. So God didn't create any privations in things. He didn't create people in the state in which they find themselves with lacks and imperfections. That came after his creation. He didn't create people blind, wounded, maimed, rotten trees, and rusted cars. God created things perfectly, and they became imperfect, but he is the author only of the good things that he made. He's not the author of the bad relationships between them, nor of the privations or lacks in them. Augustine, who lived around 400 AD, St. Augustine, one of the greatest Christian thinkers of all time, himself used to believe that evil was a thing. He belonged to a cult called the Manichaeans. And he was delivered from this particular cult, and he wrote a whole series of writings called the Anti-Manichaean Writings. And in his Anti-Manichaean Writings, he gives this answer to the problem of evil, which we're suggesting to you now. And here's how Augustine says you can tell that evil is a negative or a lack in something. He said, take all the good out of something, and what's left? Nothing. Take every good characteristic out of anything you can think of. Take every good characteristic out of this piece of paper. What's left? Nothing whatsoever. But take every evil characteristic out of something, and what's left? Something better. Therefore, evil is the negative and good is the positive. For when you take all of the good away, nothing's left, but when you take all the evil away, something better is left. Evil is that negative parasite, lack, or privation that exists in good things to rust them, to corrupt them, to wound them, or to private them of something that ought to be there. Well, you say that may answer the first problem, but it certainly doesn't answer the second problem, and that is, where did the privation come from? And that leads us to the second aspect of the problem of evil, the problem of the source of evil. If God created only good things, and God didn't create any privations, and he didn't make any bad relationships, then where did they come from? Where did the cosmic flat tire occur? Where did the cosmic wound come from? If he didn't wound it, who wounded it? Everything he made is perfect. How can a perfect being wound it? God didn't wound it. Perfect beings shouldn't be able to wound it. Where'd the wound come from? Where did the blindness come from? Who caused the blindness if God didn't? And that, of course, is a separate question. How can good be the source of evil? The answer to this question is, in one word, human freedom, or free will, if we want to take it in the broader sense, apply it to angels. One of the good things God made was free will. Now, during the whole Vietnam War and all of the marches, I never saw anyone march with a placard, "Down with freedom, back to bondage, away with liberty." Liberty is a good thing. Freedom, right? Nobody's against freedom. Freedom is good. It's good to be free. And if someone should rise to his feet and say, "I don't want to be free," he really does, doesn't he? Because he still cherishes the freedom to be able to say that. So he proves that he really does want to be free, even if he says, "I don't want to be free." I could say I don't exist, but I'd have to exist in order to say it. And I could say I don't like freedom, but I have to cherish the freedom in order to say that I don't cherish freedom. Now, if it is good to be free, then freedom means the ability to go one way or the other way. Freedom means
the ability to love God or to hate God. So one of the good things God created was the freedom to love him or to hate him. But with that freedom comes the possibility of evil. You say, aha, that's it. God did not create the actuality of evil. He merely created the possibility of evil. And that's correct. God did create the possibility of evil. But the possibility of evil is not an evil. The possibility of an evil is good, because the possibility of evil is also the possibility of a greater good. Every time I allow my son to take the car, I allow the possibility of evil. Every time I hop in an airplane, I allow the possibility of evil. And you could go right through all the other illustrations in life. Every time you go skiing, you allow the possibility of breaking a leg. Every time you go swimming, you allow the possibility of drowning. It's hard to drown on the beach. But with the possibility of evil is a good, right? And is the possibility of a greater good. I was in Aspen a couple years ago and just swooping down those mountainsides, and I didn't mind whether I could break my leg or break my neck. That was just absolutely ecstatic, you know. Just marvelous to be there at the top of the mountain swooping down. I was not worried about the possibility of evil. I was worried only about the freedom, the emancipation, the possibility of the greater good that comes from skiing. Likewise, when God created man, he created man with free will, and that freedom is the possibility for evil, but it's the possibility for the good of worshiping him. Sometimes run into atheists, as I debate atheists around the country on various universities, who will say something like this: if there's a God, let him strike me down with lightning in 2 minutes. Tick, 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 ha, 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 no God. Now, what did they prove? They didn't prove there isn't any God. They might have proven if there is a God, he's very loving, very patient. They might have proven that God is not like Mother Nature, that he doesn't, you know, lightning bolts, not nice to fool Mother Nature, boom, boom. That's margarine, that's not butter, boom. Yeah. You see, if God did strike down the atheist, I would be a little leery about believing in that kind of God. What kind of God would that be who says, do it my way or boom? Either love me or I'll annihilate you. C.S. Lewis has a beautiful book entitled The Great Divorce. It's not about marriage, but it's about the great divorce between heaven and hell. It's about people in hell who get on a bus and go to heaven. And on this bus in heaven, they find out that heaven is too heavy for them. Heaven is not the place, they don't fit. That heaven is worse than hell for somebody who's not equipped to be there. And the point that C.S. Lewis makes is that God never forces someone against his will to go to heaven. That even hell flows from the love of God. That God loves people so much that he'll never twist their arm and force them to worship him. Can you imagine going to a concert? Think of the music that you can't stand at all. Somebody talks you into going, you're bored to death, you fall asleep. And then they say, why don't you stay an hour longer? Or why don't we go to one a whole week? You say, I'll be bored to death. How would you like to go forever? That'd be hell. How would you like to go to a place where everybody's worshiping and praising God forever when you can't stand being there a half hour on earth? You see, God is gracious and not forcing people against their will. Or think of this, girls. How would you think of the ugliest guy, the guy that you hate the worst, how would you like to be forced to marry him? Now, while you're thinking about that illustration, think a little more deeply. What if when I proposed to my fiancée, I said to her, Barb, I really love you and I want you to marry me. And she smiles and I think, aha. And she says, Norm, I think you're a nice guy and I respect you, but I really don't want to marry you. And I'm a little bit offended and I say, well, no, wait a minute. Let me repeat this again. I will love you until death do us part. I'll provide for you. I'll treat you as my own self. I'll do anything for you. We'll be happy together. I really love you. Marry me. And she says, well, I respect you, and I think you're an
nice person, but I don't want to marry you. And then I really get offended and I say, listen, I love you so much, I'm going to force you to love me. And someone says, wait a minute, forced love is not love, it's rape. And God is not a divine rapist. He will never force anyone to love him. That's why there's a hell. You see, free will is a tremendous risk. Once you create something free, you have made a tremendous risk. You have risked the part that they may bow before you and worship you. Or you have risked the possibility they may thumb their nose at you. That's what freedom involves. Freedom involves the ability to love God or to hate God, to love others or to hate others. It's good to be free. But with freedom can come bad relationships, because hate's a bad relationship. Indifference is a bad relationship. Taking a baseball bat and hitting somebody over the head with is a bad relationship. Hit the ball, good relationship. Hit the crown of the head, a bad one. So that God created free creatures, and freedom is the answer to the second problem of evil, the problem of the source. Where did it come from? Now, before we leave that point, let me answer one more question that is sometimes asked, and that is, now wait a second here. If God created Lucifer, and Lucifer was good, and Lucifer was the one who first sinned, and then he tripped up Adam and Eve and they sinned, what caused Lucifer to sin? What we say in our house when somebody is losing an argument is we wiggle our little finger and we say, got you in the corner, got you in the corner, what are you going to do now? Here God created a perfect being, gave him perfect freedom. What caused him to sin? Wasn't God that caused him to sin, because God can't force anyone to sin. What caused Lucifer to sin? If he's absolutely perfect, wasn't any imperfection in his nature, wasn't anybody tempting him, nobody was tempting him. He was the first one that later tempted Adam. What caused Lucifer to sin? Before we answer the question directly, let me give you an analogous situation to show that every question that can be asked does not presuppose that the question is meaningful. And the reason you're tripped by that question is because you think that it's a meaningful question. It is not a meaningful question. That is, it's not meaningful in the sense that there is no answer to the question. For instance, if I said to a bachelor, when did you stop beating your wife? That's meaningful in the sense that it's grammatically stateable. There's no contradiction in it. It's not like asking where are the square circles exactly, which is a contradiction. But when did you stop beating your wife is not meaningful in the sense that he doesn't have a wife. It implies something that's not the case. Second illustration. Where was the man when he jumped off the bridge? You say, well, that one I got. He was in the air. No, that was after he jumped. You say, well, then he was on the bridge. No, that was before he jumped. Where was the man when he jumped off the bridge? So run through that again. He was in the air. No, that was after he jumped. Well, he was on the bridge then. No, that was before he jumped. Where was he when he jumped? I had a grandfather, my wife's grandfather, really, who was good at figuring these things out, and he thought about that for about 10, 15 minutes, and he said to me, I know where he was. He was beside himself. Well, that's not the answer. There really is no answer. Why? Because you are trapped into thinking that's a meaningful question. It is not a meaningful question. You are asking a pinpoint question of a process action. We call in philosophy a category mistake. Where is a pinpoint question of jumping, which is a process action? There is no where to a jump, because a jump is a whole process. It's not a single where. So when you're asking where was the man when he jumped, you're making a category mistake. It's like asking how did the blue taste? Blue doesn't have any taste. So you're confusing categories. Blue doesn't taste. Now, back to what caused Lucifer to sin? Category mistake. Meaningless question. He was the first cause of sin, and you can't ask what is the first cause of the first cause. If he was the first cause, if his freedom was the first cause of the first sin, you can't ask what caused the first cause. It's like asking who made God. Nobody made God. He's the one that made everything else. He's the unmade maker. And free will is the first cause of sin. If somebody makes you sin, that's not a sin. What if somebody put my finger on a trigger and squeezed my hand and shot him? Well, then I didn't freely kill him, did I? So if something made Lucifer do it, he didn't do it freely. Nothing made him to do it. He did it. Why do I love my wife? Nobody's making me love my wife. I freely choose to love my wife. Nobody made Lucifer sin. Nobody made Adam. He was tempted, but nobody made him do it. Somebody said it was not the apple on the tree. That didn't make him do it. You say, well, it looked good, but that didn't make him do it. In fact, it wasn't the apple on the tree. It was really the pear on the ground that got us in trouble. It's all right. But nothing made him do it. He freely chose to do it, you see. Adam freely chose to sin, and Lucifer freely chose. So when we ask, who made God? Meaningless question. What made Lucifer to sin? Meaningless question. His free will was the cause of sin. Adam's free will, your free will. Is freedom good? Yes. Is freedom the possibility of evil? Yes. But it's also the possibility of a greater good. Now that leads us to the third question. And the third question is this. What is the purpose of evil? When you ask what caused evil, it's free choice caused it. What caused the first choice? That's a meaningless question. The first choice is the first cause. But when you ask the purpose of evil, that's a meaningful question. Why did God permit evil? Now, if I go over there and knock my head on the wall because it feels so good when I stop, you would think something's wrong with me. On the other hand, if I allow my daughter to go to the dentist chair to feel the painful extraction from her mouth and my pocketbook, if I allow that evil, you would say that's good. It's good to allow some evils, isn't it? It's good to allow some evils because they lead to a greater good. Just a couple weeks ago, there appeared in a magazine an article which quoted a doctor who did one of the experts on leprosy. And this doctor, who is an expert on leprosy, discovered something that was amazing to me. I never knew before that lepers' fingers and toes and feet do not destroy because of leprosy. Leprosy does not destroy hands and toes. Do you know how they get destroyed? They get destroyed because leprosy destroys the nerve system and the person no longer has any feelings there, and he destroys his own hands. He picks up things that are too hot, or he hits his finger with a hammer, and he destroys his own fingers and toes. That leprosy is a form of self-destruction because, get this, there is no pain. There is no pain. Pain has a good purpose. What is the good purpose for pain? The doctor concluded, to save us from self-destruction. We would destroy ourselves if we didn't have pain mechanisms there. Now, the follow-up with this was fascinating to me. What he discovered is that they could make mechanisms to alert the leper when pain was coming. So they actually set up hearing aids. And when pain was coming, a little bleep would go on in the ear. Do you know what they discovered? People did not heed the bleeps. They still destroyed their fingers because the bleep was not severe enough pain. So they went to louder bleeps. They didn't work. They finally went to shock treatment, that anything that would cause the person to destroy himself, there would be a little shock. That's the only thing that worked, which is the exact parallel of pain in the human body. But the one other thing they found was this, that if the thing was available for the individual to control, he would turn down the control. So that if he wanted to do something that he was afraid he might get a shock treatment, he would turn down the control or turn off the button so he wouldn't get the shock treatment. In other words, he was outsmarting himself by avoiding pain. He was destroying himself. And the doctor concluded the only way for pain to be effective to save us from self-destruction is to have pain out of man's reach. Pain out of man's reach. That's exactly why God has pain in the world. He has pain, one, to keep us from destroying ourselves, and two, he has it out of our reach because we would turn off the button if it weren't out of our reach.
C.S. Lewis wrote a book entitled The Problem of Pain. In this book, The Problem of Pain, he gives a line that I think most beautifully summarizes this whole matter. Why does God permit pain? Quote, God whispers to us in our pleasures. Two, God speaks to us in our conscience. Three, God shouts to us in our pain. Pain is God's megaphone to arouse a morally deaf world. Let me give some images to those. You're on Miami Beach. The breeze is blowing through the palms. God is whispering, saying, I'm good. It's great to be alive. Isn't it wonderful? God whispers in pleasure. You're buzzing down a road 75 in a 55-mile speed zone, and you see a crazy hot rod, the red blinking light in your mirror, and you feel it kind of down in your stomach, and you get a ticket for going 20 miles over the speed limit. God speaks a little louder in conscience. I was doing something wrong. Third illustration, you're lying flat on your back in a hospital and tubes are coming down into your body and you're wound up in bandages. God shouts a little louder in pain. Pain is God's megaphone to arouse a morally deaf world. See, pain has a good purpose. Pain has many good purposes. Why does God permit suffering? Because there are a lot of good reasons for permitting suffering and pain. Why does God allow evil and wickedness? Why do I allow my daughter to go to the dentist chair? Why does God give pain? So we don't destroy ourselves. It's God's warning that something's wrong with our world, that something's wrong with our life, that we should look up to Him. How many of you have read or heard of the book Johnny, J-O-N-I? Quadriplegic girl, no control over hands or feet, puts a pin. There could not be both pain and God. But if we can show that God does have some good purpose for permitting pain, it would waylay that argument. In fact, the argument is waylaid even without showing there are good purposes, because there's a difference between these two things. God has some good purpose for permitting pain that we don't know about. God has some good purpose that we do know about. Now, in order to justify God, we do not have to know the purposes. There just has to be a purpose. He may have some purpose that I'm unaware of. Romans 11:33 says, His ways are unsearchable. His judgments past finding out. Deuteronomy 29:29 says, The secret things belong unto the Lord our God, but unto us and to His children are things that are revealed. So I'm not attempting here to unscrew the inscrutable for you. I'm not attempting to say that I know all of the good purposes that God has. But I do think He has revealed some of them, and I think He's given us an indication so that we would not be totally in the dark. And here are the indications. One good purpose of suffering is that suffering is sometimes a result of our own free choices on ourselves. See, if we can show how suffering is related to a condition of or a result of or a byproduct of freedom, and we know that it's good to be free, then we've explained suffering in terms of human freedom. The purpose of evil is explained in terms of the source of evil, which is freedom. And in a free universe where I can freely abuse myself, I can bring suffering on myself. For instance, if I become a drug addict, if I freely choose to do that and freely choose to destroy myself by drugs, my freedom was used to destroy myself. I'll get little warnings from God along the way. You'll get the little warning pains, you know. You get spaced out here or there, and you do too much, you have a bad trip. Well, those are the warning pains. God is saying, don't destroy yourself. But if I don't heed those warning pains, and I destroy myself with drugs, that's part of the result of being free. Secondly, in a free universe, freedom can bring evil on someone else. I'm not only free to destroy myself, but if I'm free, I am sometimes free to hurt someone else. If I freely take a baseball bat and hit my wife over the head, my freedom to express myself caused suffering on her. I hear people say, oh, I have peace, peace. And you look around them and everybody else has got the pieces. Well, they're free to have peace while everybody else has the pieces.
That's one of the results of a free universe, where people are free to destroy themselves. They're also free to hurt others. Where a man is free to get drunk, the result is a hangover. But if he's free to get drunk, his children may be in poverty because he may be drinking up all of the money that should be going into providing for his family. So what's free for the father is a suffering for the son. Thirdly, in a free universe, some acts of freedom bring evil on us directly, some bring evil on us indirectly, and some bring evil as a byproduct of a good. If I freely choose to go swimming and accidentally drowning is a byproduct of the freedom to enjoy swimming. If I freely choose to go skiing and accidentally break my leg, breaking my leg is a byproduct of the freedom to ski. So evil sometimes results as a byproduct of free choices. It's good to be free, but evil results as a byproduct of that freedom. Now, I'm inclined to think that tornadoes and hurricanes fit in this category. I'm inclined to believe that in a universe where there are good forces like cold air and hot air and precipitation and seasons and growth and plants, all of which make up our world, that sometimes there's going to be a bad combination of cold air and hot air which is going to spawn a tornado. So that tornadoes are spin-offs of a good world. They are evil byproducts of good processes. And we should not think of them as evil in themselves, but as a byproduct of the good that is there. Also, evil or suffering can be explained in the following way. Some pain is a warning that greater physical pain is coming. The leper, the pain that he should have in his finger is a warning of the greater pain of going to lose it. Or if I get a pain in my side, that's a good pain because it says you need an appendectomy, or a pain in my chest, you need to slow down, you're going to have a heart attack. So warning pains are good pains to warn us of some worse physical pain that's coming. Or some pains are warnings about moral pains that are coming. A physical pain to warn you of a worse moral pain. Pain is God's megaphone, Lewis says. God is warning you, hey, slow up, man, because something is going to happen if you don't slow up. There are worse moral consequences to come. If you were standing on a cliff that had just washed out in the road at night and trucks were coming and they were going over that cliff and because the road washed out just and you stood there and smiled as you watched the trucks go by, crash, crash, something be wrong with you, right? You should warn them. And pain is God's megaphone to warn a world that there's something coming a little later. Bertrand Russell, in his book Why I'm Not a Christian, said Jesus wasn't even kind because he threatened people with hell. And that's not kind, to threaten people with hell. That's the same book that Bertrand Russell said Jesus wasn't kind because he drowned pigs. Anyone who unnecessarily drowns pigs is unkind. Remember those pigs that the demons went into pigs and they did that swine dive over the hill? Well, just think about that for a moment. Bertrand Russell was more interested in the swines than he was the guy who was possessed of demons. Jesus was kind. He's kind to humans. It was the demons that were unkind to the pigs, not Jesus. The demons made the pigs drown. And Jesus was kind because if there is a hell, it's more kind to remind people, hey, the trucks are going over the cliff. The trucks are going to crash. Pain is God's megaphone. Pain is God's warning sign saying, look up, something tragic is about to happen. Well, finally, let me say this. People will often reply to the argument by saying, well, why did God create a world that he knew was going to go this way anyway? The answer to that is very simple. It's better to have loved and to have lost than not to have loved at all. It's better to create beings who are free and giving them the opportunity to express their freedom than not to create them at all. To say, I'll only create people who worship me. And if you're not going to worship me, I'm not going to make you. Furthermore, what would you think if I threw three dice and they came up three sixes, and I threw them again and they came up three sixes, and I did it 100 times in a row and it came up three sixes? You would say, the dice are loaded. What would you think of a universe where everybody obeys God? Everybody does the right thing. Nobody sins. Nobody thumbs their nose at them. You say, the dice are loaded. God created man really free. And some people really freely choose to go to heaven. And some people really freely choose to go to hell. And you know what God says to them? The Great Divorce, C.S. Lewis. There are only two kinds of people. The first kind of person says, Thy will be done, O God. The second kind of person, God looks at him and says, Thy will be done. Have it your way. Hell is where people go who want to do their own thing. Did you ever meet five spoiled brats who are all doing their own thing? How'd you like to be in a room with 100 million spoiled brats all doing their own thing? That's chaos. How'd you like to be a place where everybody's doing the same thing? That's harmony and unity. Heaven is the place where everyone says, Thy will be done, O God. And hell is the place where God says, I made you free. I want you to go to heaven. I gave you the opportunity, but have it your way. Thy will be done. If Bertrand Russell stood before God and God said, Bertie, I'll give you three choices. One, recant of everything you said, say you're sorry, bow down and worship me. Two, I'll snuff you out of existence if you don't do my thing. Or three, go on thinking what you want to think and willing what you want to will forever. What do you suppose Bertrand Russell would choose? He would choose the latter. It's not fair to say, I'll make you, and if you go my way, I'll make you happy. If you don't, I'll snuff you out of existence. Thy will be done, but never coercive. Love will never force itself on anyone, and the reason that there's evil in this universe is because God is love and he made creatures who can love him and they're free to hate him, and it's better to love them and lose some than not love them at all.